This is the second day of this November 2009 seven-day session, and we'll return to our text of yesterday, the teachings of the 19th and 20th century Chan master Xu Yun. And this is from the book Chan and Zen Teaching, Series 1. He continues, as to the Dharma, fundamentally there is no such thing, because as soon as it is expressed in words, the meaning will not be true. Just see clearly that mind is Buddha, and there will be no more ado. This is self-evident, and all talk of practice and realization are the demon's words. I'm reminded of an exchange that's recorded in a book called The Golden Age of Zen by John Wu, where two great Chinese masters, well, one great master and one who is and has yet to become a great master, are talking, and the master Kuaishan says to Yangshan, he asks him, in all the 40 roles of the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, how many are the words of the Buddhas and how many are the words of the demons? And Yangshan says, they all belong to the demons. And Kuaishan was so pleased with this response that he said to another disciple, from now on, no one will be able to do anything to Yangshan. Zen, of course, or Chan, has historically been referred to as a teaching beyond words, without reliance on the sutras. Because words are just a faint shadow of the real thing. In all matters, there is the thing itself, and then there are the words, the labels, the talk about the thing. And you can say that the words just obscure the thing itself, the direct experience. Of course, it's virtually impossible to teach without words. And so there are lots of words. There are billions of words in the Zen texts and the Buddhist canon. But they're all pointing to that which is beyond words, which is the direct experience, the thing itself. As to the Dharma, fundamentally there is no such thing, because as soon as it is expressed in words, the meaning will not be true. Bodhidharma, who came to the East to directly point at man's mind for the perception of self-nature leading to the attainment of Buddhahood, clearly indicated that all living beings on earth were Buddhas. All living beings on earth are Buddhas. The realization of this pure and clean self-nature, together with complete harmony with it, without contamination from attachment, and without the least mental differentiation, while walking, standing, sitting, and lying by day or night, is nothing but the self-evident Buddhahood. Notice he says here, the realization of this self nature together with complete harmony with it. So you can have the first without the second. You can have the insight and yet still not have integrated that insight into your life. Roshi Kaplow used to say this at every workshop, that even after an initial Kensho experience, even after that first seeing through self and other, still the force of habit mind-body habit is so strong that we continue to be pushed here and there by the force of our karmic momentum. It's very sobering to have seen the nature of things, see the illusory nature of the ego, and then still see oneself reacting to others in unwholesome ways. So there's the realization, then there's the task, the long task of coming into complete harmony with what we know through our direct experience. And the attachments that we have built up of every kind, the attachments of body, the attachments of mind, which are the real devilish attachments, these do not yield without a struggle. And he goes on, it does not require any application of mind or use of effort. What is he talking about? Think of the effort we put in sesshin. It does not require any application of mind or use of effort. How could it if we are already enlightened? If the self nature from the time we were born has always been complete, bright, shining, how could it require effort or application of mind if we have always been whole and complete just as we are? But there is this ignorance of that fact, ignorance of our own enlightened nature. And so we work, we apply ourselves in order to, going back now to the first sentence of yesterday's Teisho, the first sentence in this chapter, to wipe out the impurities which soil the mind so that the fundamental face of self-nature can really be perceived. It's really a matter of just letting go of the mental obstructions that prevent us from seeing things as they are, seeing ourselves as we are. But it's not a matter of, strictly speaking, it's not a matter of accomplishing something, or even achieving or attaining something. It's just opening our eyes. He goes on, moreover, there is no place for either action or deed, and no use for words, speech, and thought. For this reason, it is said, that the attainment of Buddhahood, let's call it enlightenment, the attainment of enlightenment is the most free and easy thing, which relies only on oneself and does not depend on others. If all living beings on this earth are not willing to pass long eons through the successive four kinds of birth in the six realms of existence to stay permanently immersed in the sea of suffering, and if they wish to attain Buddhahood with the accompanying enjoyment of true eternity, true bliss, true personality, and true purity, they should sincerely believe the true words of the Buddha and patriarchs and lay down all attachments without thinking of either good or evil. All of them will certainly be able to become Buddhas on the spot. So here he's laying out what's at stake. The risk of passing through long eons of birth and death. These four kinds of birth is just a conventional way of referring to, well, the four kinds of birth in the six realms of existence is a way of understanding our transmigration through many rebirths of different kinds. The four kinds of birth are birth from eggs, womb, humidity, and transformation. The six realms of existence, of course, are the six realms of unenlightened existence. Hakuin, we recite it in our Hakuin verse in the beginning of Taisho. From dark path to dark path, we've wandered in darkness. How can we be free from birth and death? And then he holds out the negative, and then he points to these four aspects of nirvana, which we chant in the Hakuin chant, eternal, joyous, selfless, and pure. I think to many people, this specter of endlessly making the rounds through the pain of life and death isn't really much of a motivation to practice. It's more, I think for most people, it's more of a other kinds of pain, just psychological pain, the pain of being tied up all the time with the ego and its machinations. But this is the bigger. He's presenting the larger picture of what lies before us if we fail to become what we already are. He goes on, all living beings on this earth have been, for countless eons, deluded and sunk in the bitter ocean of birth and death, rising and falling in their endless transmigrations. Being deluded, confused, and upset, they turn their back on enlightenment and unite with impurities. Unite with impurities. when facing a choice between going with our egoistic tendencies, our selfish tendencies, or not, he's saying we habitually go with our selfish tendencies. And then he offers a metaphor here. They are just like gold thrown into a manure pit where it not only falls into disuse, but is also deplorably soiled. Because of his great compassion, the Buddha was compelled to set up 84,000 Dharma doors to enlightenment so that living beings of different natural capacities could use them to cure the 84,000 ailments caused by their habitual greed, anger, and delusion. In the same way, you are taught to use a shovel, brush, water, and cloth to wash, brush, polish, and scrub the dirty piece of gold. He's referring, of course, to the practice of Zazen. It is a cleaning. Everyone here knows, otherwise you wouldn't be here, everyone knows what a sense of cleaning or brightening comes from good sitting, and certainly comes from sesshin. One feels polished, brighter, cleaner. He goes on, our sect advocates Chan training. This training centers on realization of mind and perception of self-nature, that is, an exhaustive investigation into one's fundamental face. The Dharma door, which consists in the clear awakening to the self-mind and through perception of the fundamental nature, has been handed down ever since the Buddha held up a flower until after Bodhidharma's coming to the East, with frequent changes in the method of practice. And then I'll just sort of paraphrase here. He talks about how in the early days of Chan, the Tang Dynasty and the Sung Dynasty, which followed it, most adherents of the Chan sect became enlightened after hearing a word or sentence. There was no fixed dharma that was taught. In their questions and answers, the role played by a master was only to untie the bonds fettering his disciple according to available circumstances, just like the giving of an appropriate medicine for each particular ailment. In and after the Sung Dynasty, human potentialities became duller, and the instructions given by the masters were not carried out by their disciples. For instance, when they were taught to lay down everything and not to think of either good or bad, practitioners could not lay down anything and could not stop thinking of either good or bad. Under these circumstances, the ancestors and masters were compelled to devise a poison against poison method by teaching their followers to inquire into a koan. Let me just, before we go further, bring home more clearly what this is referring to. When they were taught to lay down everything and not to think of either good or bad, practitioners could not lay down anything and could not stop thinking of either good or bad. Well, one example, very common, that everyone can relate to, of that that makes it so difficult to do is thinking about one's practice. How many hours do people waste in Sesshin and outside Sesshin thinking about their practice, judging it as either good or bad? And then, of course, at the same time, judging oneself. This is a very deeply ingrained obstruction that most people have to struggle with. And it's so automatic. It's so habitual. It's so much so that many people, it takes a long time before they realize how habitual it is, before they can start to catch themselves doing it reflexively. It's sort of this almost constant refrain in the back of the mind of assessing one's progress or lack of progress as one sees it. This is what impedes one's progress, is thinking about progress. It's just another form of dwelling on the self, my practice. Got to lay that down. How do we do it? Through absorption in the practice. When, to the degree that we are absorbed in our koan or our breath practice, or whatever our practice is, to that degree we will be free of thoughts of good and bad, right and wrong, progress, judgments, self. And so, because of these difficulties, he says the masters came up with, to fight poison with poison, they came up with the koan. He goes on, their disciples were even taught to hold a meaningless koan as firmly as possible in their minds without loosening their grip even for the shortest possible moment. In the same way that a rat will stubbornly bite the board of a coffin at a fixed spot until it has made a hole. The aim of this method was to use a single thought to oppose and arrest myriad thoughts, because the masters had no alternative. It was like an operation which became imperative when poison had been introduced into the body. So, as most of you know, for the first couple hundred, 300, 400 years of Zen practice, koans, one didn't work on koans. But then the masters came up with these stories and dialogues that they assigned to their students, that if taken very seriously and earnestly, had the power to deliver the student from the tyranny of this chattering mind. I was using the word, when he's referring to a koan, he's using the word thought very loosely. When you're absorbed in a koan, especially in a breakthrough koan like mu or who am I, what is this, what am I, one is really beyond thought. That's the point of it, to get us into this realm of no mind. But until we get to that point, then we can really find ourselves pondering the contradictory nature of the koan. There were many koans devised by the ancients, but later only koans were taught, such as, "Who is dragging this corpse here?" and "What was my fundamental face before I was born?" In the present day, Shuyun says, the masters use the koan, "Who is the repeater of Buddha's name?" Now here, this is something that I don't know that we've heard from any other text in Taisho, is this 20th century koan, "Who is the repeater of Buddha's name?" And it indicates that it became common to combine the practice of Zen with the practice of Pure Land. The Pure Land practice is to recite this formula, Namu Amida Butsu. That's the Japanese version, I don't know the Chinese, in which the idea is to just to place one's faith in Amida Buddha. Let's not get into it. It's not what we're doing here. But this is a way that Shuyun, and presumably some of his peers and his predecessors too, this is how they made a Pure Land practice into a sort of Zen practice by asking, okay, who is this one who's repeating the name? It's really not so different from who is eating, who is walking. He continues with this, "All these koans have only one meaning, which is very ordinary and is nothing peculiar about it. If you look into him who is reciting a sutra, who is holding a mantra, who is worshiping Buddha, who is taking a meal, who is wearing a robe, who is walking on the road, and who is sleeping, the reply to who will invariably be the same. It is mind. Word arises from mind, and mind gives rise to word. Thought arises from mind, and mind gives rise to thought. Myriad things come from mind, and mind gives rise to myriad things. In reality, a koan is the head of a thought." And the translator says here, that is an anti-thought, not A-N-T-I, but A-N-T-E, this thought or no thought that precedes a thought. The head of thought, or this that precedes thought, is nothing but mind. To make it plain, before a thought arises, it is a koan. From the above, we know that to look into a koan is to look into the mind. The fundamental face before one's birth is mind. Or we could say, mu is mind. To look into one's fundamental face before one's birth, or mu, is to look into one's mind. Self-nature is mind, and to turn inwards, the hearing, to hear the self-nature, is to turn inward one's contemplation, to contemplate the self-mind. So, just to go back here where he says all of these questions, who is wearing a robe, who is eating, who is walking, the answer to all of them will invariably be the same. It is mind. Well, okay, but then what is mind? It's not exactly giving away the koan by saying it is mind. The problem with asking what is mind is it would much more likely engender thoughts than what is mu, or who am I? Who am I can also generate thoughts about oneself, but once one gets going on that koan, you know enough not to make it into self-analysis. A practitioner should keep under control all his six sense organs and take good care of this koan by looking into where a thought usually arises until he perceives his pure self nature free from all thoughts. Well, when he says we should keep under control our six sense organs, well, one example of that is to keep the eyes down. Maintain silence. That's also, the tongue is a sense organ. And so forth with the other senses. Except hearing. We're naturally open to every sound. But even there, let's say at home, we face the challenge of what we want to expose our ears to. That too involves keeping under control the ear. This continuous, close, quiet, and detached investigation will lead to a still and shining contemplation. Here he's talking about samadhi, the outcome of which will be the wiping out of both body and mind, without the least thing being left behind. Of course, he means here, when he says wiping out of both body and mind, means wiping out one's attachment to one's body and one's thoughts about the body and thoughts about the mind and thoughts about practice, thoughts about self. Without the least thing being left behind. Thereafter, this absolute immutability. Here he's talking about this profound sense of silence, of calm, should be maintained in every state while walking, standing, sitting, and lying by day or night. Then he quotes a previous master, Cao Feng, who said, "When a student looks into a koan with the same steadiness with which a broken tile, when thrown into a deep pond, plunges straight down 10,000 feet to the bottom, if he fails to become awakened in 7 days, anyone can chop off my head and take it away." And then Xu Yun comments, "Dear friends, these are the words of an experienced master. They are true and correspond to reality. They are not deceitful words to cheat people." So if we had the strength of mind, the aspiration to plunge straight into this mu, whatever our practice is, ignoring everything else, but just with this kind of extraordinary single-mindedness, then every person would have this possibility of coming to awakening in 7 days. Then he says, "Then why in the present generation are there not even a few who attain enlightenment in spite of the great number who hold a koan in their minds? This is because their potentialities are not so sharp as those of the ancients. It is also because students are confused about the correct method of training and of holding a koan. They go all over the place seeking instruction, and the result is that when they get old, they are still not clear about the meaning of the koan and how to look into it. They pass their whole lives clinging to words and names and applying their minds to the tale of the koan. Here there's a footnote meaning that explaining that the tail of the koan rather than the head, this is just repeating the koan mechanically without getting beyond that, getting into the real essence of it. In other words, it's being attached to the words of the koan. That's the tail, rather than getting to the what they call here the head of the koan, that which precedes the words, that which the words point to, that out of which the words arise. Practice for awakening to the truth is easy and is also difficult. For example, when we turn on the electric light, this is possibly the first reference in any Teisho, Sesshin Teisho, to electric lights. Most of the masters I comment on in Teisho, in Sesshin, are from ancient times, long before electricity was developed. For example, when we turn on the electric light, if we know how, in a finger snap, there will be light, and the darkness, which has lasted for a myriad years, will disappear. If one does not know how to turn on the light, the electric wires will be interfered with, and the lamp will be damaged, resulting in an increase of passions and ignorance. So he's making a very important point here, that if we knew, really, truly knew how to apply the mind, then we could accomplish this matter of awakening in no time. But instead, what happens is when we think that we're concentrating on, say, the koan, it doesn't matter what, the breath too, when we think that we're applying ourselves to our practice, what we later discover, if we stick with it, what we later discover is that we're really just as much involved in our thoughts. That when we think we're absorbed in mu, or concentrating on mu, that actually there is a film of thought activity that's getting between us and mu. So how do we learn how to apply this mind most effectively so we can do what is really, ultimately, very simple? What we do is we work. We apply ourselves as a way of finding our way through these thoughts that clutter the mind, and so that we can then see the practice for what it is. See the koan or the breath for what it is. We do our best. We do our best recognizing that we have a lot of garbage in the mind that gets in the way. But we just have to roll up our sleeves and start heaving that garbage overboard. Therefore, he says, practitioners should harmonize body with mind and become calm, free from all impediments and from the view of self and other, so as to bring about a perfect unity with their latent potentialities, that is, with the self nature. Fundamentally, this method used in Chan training is invariably the same, but the training is both difficult and easy to beginners as well as to old hands. So he's talked about Well, it goes on. So where does its difficulty lie for a beginner? Although his body and mind are mature for it, he is still confused about the method of undergoing it. And since his practice is ineffective, he will either become impatient or spend his time dozing. When he says confused about the method of undergoing it and that the practice is still ineffective, this just means that one continues to get drawn into one's thoughts. And then it becomes confusing and it's ineffective. And he says, where does its easiness lie for a beginner? It only requires a believing, a long-enduring, and a mindless mind. A believing mind is, firstly, belief that this mind of ours is fundamentally enlightened, not differing from all enlightened ones and all living beings of the three times and the 10 directions of space. And second, belief that all dharmas, that is all teachings, all things expounded by Shakyamuni Buddha, can enable us to put an end to birth and death and to attain Buddhahood. That's where he says is the believing part that's required. Having faith, in other words, having faith in our own essential nature. A long-enduring mind consists in the choice of a method to be put into continuous practice in the present lifetime, in the next life, and in the life after next. In other words, he's saying commit to a practice, get it in your teeth, and stick with it. No matter what happens, persist, persevere in this practice. And then, where he said, then the third thing, the third requirement, he said, a believing, long enduring, and a mindless mind. The third is working with beyond thought. That's what he's calling a mindless mind, or that's working no-mindedly. Is drawing from that mind which is beyond thought. And by that, he says, by mindlessness is meant the laying down of everything so that the practitioner will become like a dead man who, while following others in their normal activities, does not give rise to the least differentiation and attachment. And then he says, where do both easiness and difficulty lie for an old hand? Someone more experienced in practice. The difficulty met by a monk who is an old hand lies in this feeling of comfort and clearness in which he stops and stays. Now, those of us who have been doing this a long time need to really prick up our ears now. The feeling of comfort and clearness in which he stops and stays. Thus, because of his dwelling in this illusion city, he does not reach the place of precious things, that is, full and complete enlightenment. He is fit for stillness, but is unfit for disturbance, and his training is, therefore, not completely effective for really full use. In the worst case, the practitioner will, when coming into contact with his surroundings, give rise to feelings of like and dislike, and of acceptance and rejection, with the result that his false thinking, both coarse and fine, will remain as firm as before. His training will be likened to the soaking of a stone in water and will become ineffective. As time goes on, weariness and laziness will slip into his training, which will become fruitless in the end. When such a monk is aware of this, he should immediately give rise to the koan again and rouse his spirits to take a step forward from the top of a 100-foot pole. That is, to go beyond whatever it is one has attained or thinks one has attained. Just to repeat this point he's making, that even for very experienced practitioners, there's still this deeply entrenched habit of dividing the world into what we want and what we don't want, what we like and what we don't like, what we accept and what we reject. If you doubt this, examine your mind and how it works in daily life and even in sesshin, with the schedule, with the things that we do, with the food, with other people. See this stubborn habit of liking and disliking, grasping at what we want and trying to reject or flee from what we don't want. All right, our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.